Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Alright guys, it's 2:30 a.m. Okay, I just finished editing this episode and I totally forgot to record the intro, so I'm not having a normal voice right now because I'm afraid I might woke up my neighbors. Welcome though to this new episode of Sugar Free in English, second episode. Thank you very much for everyone who listened to the first episode in English with Carter Morgan. Here's another one with Alistair Mark Linsell, a very, very interesting person that I met also in the English stand-up comedy scene in Paris. Alistair is a stand-up comedian / nuclear physicist, so we've talked about everything. From his improv background to the perception of science in the world. It was very, very interesting, and I hope you like this episode. Thank you to K. Mick F., who wrote an Apple Podcast review demanding more episodes in English. So here you go, K. Mick F. Thank you for showing everyone the right path. Please do the same thing. Go write a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts because we crave that as podcasters. I have a website because I guess we're in 2003 and I don't believe in Instagram and Twitter. So go check out sugarfree.com website where you can find my tour dates and all the other podcasts that I do because I want to shove my voice in everyone's ears. Again, thank you so much for listening, and I hope you'll enjoy this episode a lot like I did recording it with Alistair, and gros bisous.
Yeah, okay. it's a small city. I think it's the what's nice about Bristol because there are things. There is a reason I'm moving there.
The weather, of course.
The weather is actually probably one of the worst points because it's on the west coast and the prevailing wind is from the west, so the Atlantic, where air hits the first bit of land it finds, which is
so you have
Wales
cold
and or Bristol, and it just. It crashes down. Bristol is famous for rain.
But the UK is famous for rain in general, so...
Yeah, so Bristol is famous within the UK for rain.
So that's terrible then. It's like, I don't know if it's the same amount of rain. Seattle, it's known for having like 10 months of rain.
Really? I will go away. I'll look up the meteorological data.
Exactly.
They have that thing with weather, don't they, where it's like, oh, we're expecting like 8 months rain in like 2 days or whatever it is. Or eight months
who can
too much.
Translate that really. I mean, it's going to rain. Basically, just tell us it's going to rain.
It's going to be a lot of rain. And if you already know how much rain we have in a month, then I can put it into context for you. But if you don't.
Yeah. It's the unit measure doesn't mean anything. They should do the weather with what clothes should you wear. You know, it should be like, you know, wear this.
Yes.
Don't ask question, wear pants and this.
Do you need an umbrella? Yes.
Yes. Exactly. Who cares? Oh, it's 27 or 26. It's the same. Just wear shorts and shut up. So Bristol, except the weather, is pretty
good. So you've got like a few different theatres. There is a comedy scene.
Oh, nice.
But at the same time, it's small enough that if you want to get out and go to the countryside or, I don't know, stuff. There's nature nearby, so it's not too... Yeah. You can balance, like... It's not like London where you're trapped
city
in the concrete
all around. Well, yeah, I know there's a comedy scene because I was supposed to go 1 year with some friends, and usually what I do is every time I get vacation somewhere, I just research on Facebook if there's a comedy scene, an open mic or something.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I do not want to not to work because I hate myself and I don't want to holiday. But I'm guessing in the UK it's pretty ubiquitous. No?
Ubiquitous.
Ubiquitous.
You want comedy?
Yeah, comedy.
Yes! Yes, generally, yes. Like, any city will have a comedy scene.
Yeah.
And then if you're moving down to sort of, like, towns, it will depend on the town. So, like...
So, wait a minute. City and towns. Bristol, how many inhabitants?
That's a good question. I think about 800,000.
Well, okay, so that's a really...
I think so. I don't know. I haven't lived there yet.
Yeah.
Well, recently.
But towns, in your mind, that's way
Yeah, so towns, smaller. I would say a town is like, I don't know, 200,000.
Okay, so that's already something. Okay.
Well, no, is that a town? Right, so the framework I'm using, I grew up in Gloucestershire, and there's two towns in, like big towns in Gloucestershire, which is Gloucester, which is the Gloucestershire, and then next door is Cheltenham, where all the rich people live.
Okay.
So Cheltenham is nice. It's like a spa town, so it used to have all of the like Victorians and people going down. Yes. There's a thing called the Pittville Pump Room, and it literally is this spring of natural mineral water that comes up out of the ground. And everyone used to come along and like taste the mineral water.
Okay, so they have good skin, they have a golf course probably.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
But
a
in Gloucester, that's the... that's Gotham City.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
Really?
Yeah, no. Exactly, yeah. It's a bit like, oh man, did you ever read Terry Pratchett?
Yes.
Yeah, so you have like Ankh and Morpork, where like Ankh is fancy and Morpork is scumbag city.
They have that.
That's like Cheltenham and Gloucester, basically.
Yes.
Because Gloucester
and for
got bombed.
American friends, I guess the nice comparison would be like in Parks and Recreation, there's Pawnee, and there's that other city.
Yeah, man. Well, yeah, it's Pawnee and the
other one.
The other one.
The Bush one. Yeah. But in towns, there is still little comedy scenes.
So it depends. Like, you definitely get, like, a club somewhere that would have, like, a set of booked acts.
Okay.
But finding open spots would start to become more difficult.
Yeah.
There'd probably be open mics, but it wouldn't be like, oh, we've got five open mics. It'll be like, there'll be one comedy enthusiast in that town who's like, yeah, convinced someone in a pub that he wants this rather than a karaoke evening.
Yeah, obviously. But at least you have, in different regions, you'd have the big city where where to go to have the comedy. Here in France, it's just, basically, it's just Paris. I mean, it starts... coming up a little bit, but I mean, I lived in Toulouse.
Yeah,
in Toulouse, it's kind of a big city for students and also for Airbus. So there's a lot of expats, etc.
Airbus were also in Bristol, I think.
Oh yeah, exactly. Yeah, you're right. And still, comedian friends of mine and I, we had to create our own scene. To have somewhere to play, and it was just it's still going on now, but it's still once a week, so you know it's still not that known. Even in Paris, the audience doesn't know what stand-up is, really.
Yes. Yeah, it's funny. Because, like, when I lived in London for 5 years, and the improv scene in London, when I got there at the start, there was an improv scene. But if you compared the two between, like, the start when I got there and when I left, like, it's gone, exponential growth.
Oh, that's cool.
And it's because people have been doing that. They've been creating the scene themselves, which is really cool. Yeah, it's interesting about people not knowing what an art form is.
And discovering it.
Like, oh, hey, what's this thing? This thing's cool.
Yeah.
What do you call it? And so, like, in the UK, improv has definitely been doing that over the last 5 years. And so, like, often you'd say to people, like, oh, I'm doing an improv comedy night. And people would go, oh, is that stand-up? And you're like, no, because it's like a team of five people and we make it up and we don't have a script. And so nothing's prepared. And people would be like, still wouldn't have a handle. And like the oldest thing is like the show Whose Line Is It Anyway?
Yes.
People would go, if
does
you,
that
if you,
go on in the UK?
It's not still running, but it's okay. The, it's the major cultural touchstone, yes, for people. They go, you know that thing where people made stuff up on the telly? They go, oh yeah, well we're doing that, but in a pub.
Yeah.
Like, oh right, cool. But it's not like that. It's different.
Even though it doesn't translate that well on TV, the improv.
Yeah, I think you're right, because I think it's because there's the immediacy, yeah, of improv is, yeah, like being in the room. You want to
feel the tension.
Yeah, the only real reason that you want to see people improvising is because you want to see people taking risks. That, like, if you wanted to see perfectly scripted comedy, you'd do the improv in like a devising theatre, yes, and then you'd take the best bits, which is what people do, yeah, and then that's a sketch show.
Yeah.
But if, like, the appeal of improv is seeing people struggling.
Yeah.
Where someone throws them like a weird offer and they have to just roll with it.
And the payoff is just even better when something is funny, because, yeah, they're like, oh my God, oh my you just thought of it right now, and I know you have because I was here.
Yes, yeah. And it's that is one of the lovely things about it, is because you just have that like shared moment of everyone. Like, it's one of those real, like, you had to be there. Like, yeah, he was pretending to, yeah, like be a police captain. When I explain it now, it doesn't sound like it was funny, but trust me. It was great.
Funny, yeah. So did you start with improv before stand-up?
Yes, I did. Yeah. So I... when did I start doing improv? I started doing improv in 2006. Incidentally, also in Bristol. So I lived in Bristol for 1 year.
Yeah.
After... So I did like a gap year, but I did a gap year wrong. So, you know, the best thing to do on a gap year is to, like, go off, go traveling, yes, go to Thailand. I, my gap year, went and worked in a small engineering consultancy, which is based on, like, the...
Under the rain, and you lived in a the rainy flat.
City of Bristol. Yeah, living with my uncle. So me and my uncle were living in Bristol, and I was working in this flat, and I'd been in the office about a week, and I realized that I wasn't qualified to do any of the work, because, yes, I was straight out of school, just getting work experience, and so I wasn't qualified to do any of the interesting stuff, and if I didn't meet people my own age, I was going to go insane.
Yes.
And so basically what happened is I went straight down to the Bristol Students Union when, like, they had their freshers fair,
yeah,
and I literally went, I'm not a student here, but I want to join in.
Yes.
So
can I meet new people, please? Yeah,
I would like to. And everyone's just like, I don't really. You're in the building. Fine. And so, like, at the time, it was the University of Bristol Pantomime Society. So, like, pantomime is a very, very British tradition. And so what happens is at Christmas, it was always a pantomime. And it's normally the fairy tale, like Cinderella or Aladdin. Ours was Aladdin 2, A Lad in Trouble.
Okay, the word exists in French, but I'm realizing it's not a good translation.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's not mime.
Yeah.
It's not to do with mime at all. It's like a really, like if you could get a load of actors to just overplay,
yes,
everything.
Some kind of classical, traditional.
Yes, thing. And so there's a lot of audience participation. Okay. So there's like set bits where the audience knows that they have to join in.
Yes.
And so one of those things is like, he's behind you. So you'd have a good guy on stage who's looking out to the audience going, gosh, I'm having a great time walking through this dark and scary forest. Okay. And then behind them, a bad guy will appear. And at that point, the audience knows they all have to shout out, he's behind you.
Yeah.
And then what happens is they have like a little set piece on stage where the good guy will look left and the bad guy will move to the right,
okay,
and they'll miss each other and then they'll do the same thing in reverse, and so the, okay, good guy never catches the bad guy.
In France, this would be with marionettes, with puppets.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But not played by a real person.
We realized we could get one person, yeah, to do all of this.
It's less to pay.
The reason I started with that is because there wasn't an improv comedy society.
Okay.
But the Pantomime Society like said, oh, by the way, we also have some people who like improv.
So they branched out from this to improv.
Yes, they kind of like birthed the improv society, okay, over the course that I was there.
Were they fans of the improv scene in the US? Like, did they read books? Or because we basically had the same stand-up upbringing, because I did improv before I did a stand-up. But we had a class. We had an improv class in,
yeah,
Toulouse. I think improv here is perhaps a little older than what you're saying in France, but here they were like really scholars. Mm-hmm. I mean, the teachers were scholars in improv. That they knew the Chicago scene and they knew everything that then went through and created the art.
Yeah, so like when I first started, what you'd do is you'd move from one place to another trying to do improv. So I did it first in Bristol and then in Durham. But in all of them, it would be some people knew that the concept of making up things to be funny was a thing and that we could do it. But no one had ever made contact with those like hallowed people like Keith Johnston or like Del Close or like the big improv names, people in America. And so what would happen is you'd inevitably get someone who'd read a book and had gone, okay, guys, I've read a book and I think we're trying to do this. And so that was kind of my experience of improv until I got to London.
So this is insane because you didn't have any teachers. You didn't have, you really created totally, even in your mind, you created the...
Yeah. I mean, I think you'd start off with short form, which is where you have like lots of small set games. Like, you know that, like, for example, one's called Sitting, Standing, Bending. And it's a pretty like, it's a standard construct where you have to have three people on stage. One must be sitting down. Yes. One must be standing up and the other one must be bending over.
Yeah. Usually when you have some kind of framework, the funding can
yeah, and so based on that, the thing that's fun is seeing people struggling to maintain this, but also committing to actually do it. Because I remember sitting in like a student improv workshop that I was running where people had just forgotten that was the point of this game, and so two people were standing up, one person was sitting on the floor, and nothing was happening. I was like, this is not funny.
<That's> not happening.
You have one job.
So you were basically your own teachers.
Kind of, which was exciting, but it also means that you make quite a lot of basic mistakes.
Yes.
Because no one's ever told you, like, this is a really fundamental concept, and I know you've read it, and I know you think you understand it, but you can't actually do it yet.
Okay. So when you came to London, there was the big reveal.
Yes. I remember having this moment I was doing a class with a group called Monkey Toast, and Carrie Ad Lloyd, she's now like quite a famous comedian in the UK. She left our second, like, she did our level one class, started our level two class, and then the middle of level two class was like, I'm really sorry, guys, I'm going to have to leave you with Paul Foxcroft, who's the other guy that was involved in Monkey Toast at the time, along with a Canadian guy who ran it called David Shaw. And so she's like, I'm going to have to leave you guys with Paul because I've just been offered a Partner Sky sitcom and I got to go take that. And we were like, yeah, you do.
you go
do that. That sounds awesome. But it was, I really remember this moment where we were on stage, we were improvising a scene and Carrier just sort of stopped it, went, stop, this scene is in trouble. And I remember thinking, is it? Yeah. I thought I was having a good time. The other person's having a good time. Like, I didn't think that we were struggling. You know, when it's like, because you know when you're struggling in improv, because it just feels horrible. Yeah. And I didn't feel any of that. And she just turned to us and could see our kind of bemusement and went like, "Where do you think you are?" And I was like, "I think we're in a shop." And the other person was like, "I think we're in a park." And she was like,
"And she
that.
Saw it, and you didn't see
yeah,
it."
Yeah, exactly. And so like. One of the things that they'd often drill you on, which is a rule that you can break when you get good at it, but you need to learn the rule before you can break it, is like start a scene with who you are,
where you are,
and what you're doing. Because if you get those three things out in the first three lines, you minimize the chance for horrible confusion where someone turns around and goes like, "I'm just going to walk the dog." And you're like, what?
Yeah.
Okay, that doesn't make much sense in the shop.
And what sparked the stand-up thing from the improv?
So there was a period, I think I did maybe like four stand-up gigs back in London, and at the time, the open mic scene in London is like saturated with comedians.
Okay.
So there's loads of people that want to try out comedy, which is great.
Yeah.
There just isn't enough audience to go round.
Okay.
And so you'd often be doing these nights where...
It'd
be like, here's eight comedians and the two friends of one of the comedians who are deeply invested in their 5 minutes and not...
And empty chairs.
Yeah. And so, which I think is typical in a lot of places. But I was doing that and improv. and the improv was taking off in a way that was like really exciting. So there was a group I was in called Bleak Mouse, which is a pun on Bleak House, the Charles Dickens thing. And also just an image of a sad mouse is funny. And that was really good fun. Because there was a point where we'd done some of these classes now, so we knew these basic mistakes, we'd got rid of them, and we got to the point where our improv had gone from being like quite good but erratic to being our improv is so consistently good.
Yeah, so and you became like a good show.
Yeah, and it was amazing how you just got bookings from people going, these guys are good, okay, well, we'll book them for our thing. And okay, well, you did that was good, we'll book them for this other thing. And so on the stand-up side, it was sort of like playing to three sad people in the basement, and on the improv side, it was like playing to 80 people.
So
and
not you got much like incentive to go and
of the two on, yeah. And then being in Paris, I think there is an improv scene that's starting that I haven't really managed to connect with it whilst I've been
really
there.
The improv scene in English,
I don't know if it's in English. Oh, so that's the thing. I tried to, there was a group I think called the Improfessionnels,
yeah. There's a lot of kind of groups like these in France and in Paris, but I'm guessing you cannot become a part of
join in because
here there's a lot of improv classes. It's all about classes, and usually it's all about empowering people that work in companies, etc. You know, have to assert yourself and speak loud.
Because improvisers need to eat.
Yeah. So. It will improve a lot your PowerPoint presentation. And that was kind of like this, because when I got into improv classes, it was that. I mean, I wanted a shoe in the theater thing, and I was scared of improv, so I was, I thought, let's go to what scares you. Yep. But around me, there was a lot of that. Yeah. A lot of like shy people trying to better themselves in a way.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
And since I'm a narcissist, I went into stand up. Please go away from my stage.
Yes. I mean, that is the I guess both exciting and scary thing about stand up is it's all on you.
Yeah.
And that's great, because it means that, you know, you can go wherever you want with it, but equally, when it flies, it means you can feel super pleased with yourself. And when it crashes, there's no way you can be like, "Oh, it was a joint failure between me and the audience."
But it is kind of exhilarating when something goes well with another partner on stage, and you. I think I did 2 years or something like this, and at one point you kind of know who works
with you
and who has a comedic mind, and sometimes it just takes someone who has the same comedic culture and who knows stuff, you know.
Yeah, and there's like sometimes like just like having chemistry with someone where you sort of go like, I remember I used to improvise with someone called Freya Parker, and she's one of the best people I've ever been on stage with, and I just knew I was always safe.
Yeah, exactly.
And so you go like, okay, so you and me, we know that we're both going to listen to each other, and I know you've got good comedy instincts, I know you like my comedy instincts, and therefore we're going to be fine, unless this is that one in a thousand show where it just goes wrong because it's improvised and you can never get rid of that.
And it's fun to be surprised also, even if the other one just pitch you like something that's crazy, but you think, oh yeah, that's a good idea.
Yeah.
we can go there.
And that's nice when you find someone else's point of view both surprising, but also the surprises are nice surprises.
Exactly. But the responsibility of the stage is shared. I think perhaps it was, I'm going to be mean perhaps, but it was just that there were not enough people who were good enough for me to feel safe every time. But I love stand up from my childhood, so I think at one point I was bound to go on stage and say something for stand up, having an improv background or at least having done a little improv is great, I think.
Yeah, I think it's one of the things that I've been playing around with over the last few months of how much can you be relaxed and playful yes. with the audience before it gets to you just being self-indulgent and being like, I haven't prepared anything.
Yeah.
And this is a medium where you do expect some jokes.
Yes.
And so there's been some bits which have worked really nicely, and they've bounced kind of organically from the audience, having a chat with the audience, to me having a bit in my head pre-prepared, which I was okay. like, I didn't know I was going to try that this evening, but actually this does fit.
Yeah.
There was one gig, I can't remember what it was, where I was like, it was funny, I was chatting with some other comedians afterwards, and they were like, you do know you have that bit about that girl that got a job in MI5, which would have worked perfectly with your audience oh, yeah. interaction. I was
but
like,
you didn't think
yeah,
of it.
Just didn't think of it at the time.
And everybody was there. Why did yeah. he do it?
But that's something I quite like about the scene in Paris. It's like, it's really supportive.
Yes.
And everyone knows each other's stuff, and so everyone could be like, you do know that if you did this like next time, that'd be good.
Yeah, it's a small circle, and you end up knowing everyone, and that's pretty cool. I mean, I perform also in French. I haven't met everyone yet
yeah.
in French, but while you were doing all that, you were a physicist.
Yeah, so technically, all right, well, what am I? Who am I?
Who are you?
How should I market myself?
What's your brand, Alice?
So, let's stick with the most established brand, which is that I am a nuclear scientist. And so I work for EDF. I hold a chemistry degree, master's in chemistry from Durham University. And then after the student dream started collapsing before my very eyes, I was like, oh God, I need to find a job. And yeah. luckily I got a job working for EDF.
With a chemistry degree.
Yeah. And so that's kind of slightly a screw up on their part as well, because they do need chemists. They just didn't yeah. need as many as they hired.
remained. yeah.
Like literally the chief chemist at the end of this graduate scheme, the chief chemist got us all into a room in a pub in Gloucester and went, guys, there's no chemistry jobs this year. Diversify.
Sorry.
And so I went into training because, you know, me standing up in front of people and talking knots is something I enjoy.
Yeah.
So that's the day job. But I've also presented on the Discovery Channel. So there's a show which in various regions is called different things, but it started off being called You Have Been Warned, and then it was rebranded into Outrageous Acts of Science when it moved to America. And it's basically like a YouTube countdown show
okay.
where you have 20 YouTube clips of people doing stuff that you could never health and safety approve for a okay. real television program.
And you were presenting each and every one of those clips explaining it in the science.
So it's a mixture of different scientists. So I was there was about, I think there's 14 on the show now, and it's a mixture of engineers, physicists, okay. chemists, and the funny thing with chemistry is it tends to be explosions.
Yeah.
So
you were the explosion expert.
The explosion guy. You'd be like, and this is a giant explosion. and so, yeah, you'd get things like the military blowing up an ammo dump in Iraq, but it's like, I don't know, 400,000 tons of explosives, and you're never going to do that in anywhere
obviously
else.
Obviously not.
So you just see this giant fireball, and then someone like me pops up and goes, a fireball occurs when fuel combusts with oxygen. Yeah.
Unless you're a terrorist, then they yeah. all know you. They're taking, oh my God, you're Alistair.
Yeah, hey, man, you've explained a lot.
Thank you.
You've got to balance the oxidizer and the fuel mix.
Yeah.
Oh, I did not think
By
about
the way,
that.
Don't be in Paris in August.
We need you to keep producing explanations because we still haven't worked out all of it.
But how did you get that gig? I mean, somebody perhaps saw your improv group?
No, so I did. So there's a competition in the UK and in Europe called FameLab. And it was when I was in my third year at university. Or it might even have been second. It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
It was this competition at university where you had 3 minutes to explain anything scientific to the general public.
Oh,
and the rules were you had to have no PowerPoint, no notes, and be not boring.
Yes.
And that was it. And I did this competition in 2009, and I got... I came second.
Oh.
Which was...
What did you explain?
So I explained in the first... there was three rounds. So the first round I explained heroin, and like yeah. how heroin works. Like works on the body, and like basically did a. It was kind of like a half stand-up set.
Mm-hmm.
So it was like using the like the bridge from Star Trek as a metaphor for your body's like internal control yes. system. And so it'd be like you have internal chemicals that you produce called endorphins that make you feel good. But you then have, like, if you take heroin, you switch on all those sensors. And then the control center basically goes, these sensors are reading far too high, Captain. We must turn them down. And then it turns off all your happy feel-good chemicals, and that's called addiction. So that's a really short version of that
yeah,
talk.
Yeah, that's a good angle for this.
Yeah, and then the second one, I didn't realize I had to do a different talk in the afternoon, so I went around my friend's house, we had lunch, and over lunch I wrote another 3 minutes on... just painkillers, and then the
so you definitely stayed on the drug
on the drugs.
You
topic.
Have a drug problem.
Yeah, I basically went. This worked in the first round. I need yeah. something in the second round. I'll just use this closely related topic, and then for the final at Cheltenham Science Festival, I ended up explaining fluorescent monkeys and a. How do you make a fluorescent monkey? And B, why would you want to? like, apart from being the best lighting for a rave in the
yeah,
world ever.
Yeah.
Because
also,
the point?
When you're in jungle and, you know, your flashlight doesn't work anymore.
Yeah, you do, but you have got your tanning salon yeah. bed and you just switch that on and then all the monkeys, like, ring in the trees.
Exactly.
Yeah. so, yeah, that was how I kind of got into the science communication side of things. And it's something I really enjoyed. And then from that, I got into a few other different things. And I basically ended up at Sheffield Documentary Festival having a chat with who was at the time the Vice President of Factual Programming for Discovery Europe, who actually was lovely. Because you're talking to quite a lot of TV execs aren't famous for being super cheerful and open. And
you find the one who was sincerely like that.
And she was just lovely. And she just, like, offhand went, like, oh, I could totally see you on something like Mythbusters. And I was like, yes.
I am here. I am available.
that sounds great. And so she, nothing happened for a year. She then sent...
It's always like this.
Yeah.
Always, like, giving you, like, some dangling opportunity, and then
yeah.
silence.
And then her. Silence. And so we were then at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival doing a sketch show, and I'd sent a mail to her just being like, oh, hey, I've graduated, I'm now qualified in chemistry, so you could, you know, I'm legit qualified in this field. Also, we're doing a show at the Edinburgh Fringe. And she went, okay, great, I'll send one of my producers along. This show was quite a juvenile show. There was like a musical number about masturbation. yeah, it was really highbrow stuff. And then, so I had a...
But it worked.
So I had like a coffee with this woman before the show and was like, oh, who else are you seeing whilst you're up here? And she was like, I'm seeing Dave Gorman. I'm seeing Humphrey Carr, who won... best show that year. I'm here seeing like these, and she was just like listing like Robin Ince, like going down these massive names.
Yeah,
and then
and you,
me, and my juvenile sketch show, and I was like, okay, cool. The show's not very sciencey, just so you know. And she was like, okay, fine. And then so she went off and was like, oh, thanks, that was great, we'll stay in touch. And again, nothing happened. So I started working for EDF, and then it would have been around March in the year that I was working for EDF that I just got like a random email going, oh, hey, we're producing something for the Discovery Channel and your name's come up. Do you want to come and screen test for
That's
it?
Awesome.
And that was Outrageous Acts of Science.
Now your name is in the system.
Yeah. And believe it, like, there is kind of a system because, like, they have
yeah.
a spreadsheet, apparently. And this spreadsheet, like,
yeah.
I got another call. It didn't lead to anything, but it was like, oh, your name's in this spreadsheet?
Yeah.
And so we just thought we'd contact you.
You know, TV execs, movie execs, they're human
yeah.
and they're lazy, like everyone.
Yeah, exactly.
Once they have a name, they have a Rolodex of names. Why would they search for another person? They have this. Oh, well, why don't we use it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So here in France, you've been working where as a nuclear scientist?
In a basement. If you've seen the UK sitcom The IT Crowd,
yes,
that's quite close to my life. So,
so have you tried to turn off and on your nuclear plant?
Fortunately, I'm dealing with a simulator, so that is a legitimate thing because it's a simulation. If everything goes wrong, it's fine because it's just a computer game,
okay.
And you knew that before you built it, which is actually one of the really veering slightly into technical here, but that's one of the really powerful things about simulation, is that the design of a nuclear reactor is really complicated. Mm-hmm. Getting it to work is a big challenge. If you can get it to work in a simulator before you've spent all the money buying the kit and putting it together, then you have a much more confidence that when you buy all the kit and put it together, it's actually going to work.
So you're actually working on designs on new kind of nuclear plant? Okay, so that would be like the type 5, 6?
We're not quite that far advanced. It's a Generation 3 Plus reactor for those fans of reactor generation.
Oh, there's a lot of people.
And I know there's a lot of you out there. it's called the EPR, which is like the European... Well, it was originally called the European pressurized reactor, and then they wanted to try and sell it to America, and they realized they needed to drop the word European, and so it then became evolutionary power reactor, and then everyone kind of went, hang on a minute, like which one is it? And they just went, it's just EPR. It's like BP, it's not British Petroleum.
Let's
it's
keep
just,
the acronym
it's
and
just an acronym, and there is officially no meaning behind it now. And so that there's a big deal between France, China, and the UK to construct two of these down in Somerset, not far from Bristol, which is why I'm moving back to Bristol.
So you will visit there to see if everything is okay.
It's huge. So it is the biggest engineering project in Europe. Okay. It's like staggeringly massive. So 7% of the UK's electricity would come out of two reactors, which is a lot.
Because I know France, we have 75% of electricity from nuclear plants. But what does that mean for the UK to have just two more? It means that you knock off some oil or I don't know.
So basically, the UK, like many problems.
You see your country.
We've got a bit of a problem when it comes to like long-term infrastructure planning in our country, because politicians tend to make decisions on a short term.
Obviously,
and infrastructure is inherently long-term.
Electoral cycle.
Yeah, and so I mean, in fairness, nuclear has received pretty consistent support from successive governments in the UK, because that's the only way you get a deal over the line is by everyone going, yes, we're doing this. The problem we have is that we've got a fleet of nuclear reactors that are starting to reach the end of their life cycle.
Yeah, same in France, and I think the dismantling costs a lot of money.
Yeah, exactly. So those all need to go into decommissioning, but that means that there's like 20%, and it's now dropped off to below that was nuclear in the UK's energy supply.
Okay.
Now, the way like climate change legislation works in the UK is you have the Climate Change Committee, and they set carbon budgets for the country to basically go, we need to decarbonize. These are the carbon budgets. If you breach them, then Parliament has broken the law. And at the moment, carbon budget number 4, I don't know when it is, but I think it's like late 2020s. If our stations don't come on to replace the old stations, we're going to break our climate change commitments. So it's a huge project, and there's a clear need for it, because otherwise we'll start seeing lights going out, or we'll have to start burning more gas to
That is weird that you have commitments within your own government, because you're not in the EU anymore. Usually you have to pay a tax to the EU if you break the carbon thing, but you set up your own thing.
So it's one of the
like
things
you have to give to the Irish perhaps.
Maybe. So it's one of the things that I think the UK has been reasonably good at leading on. We should be leading on it, because if you look at our legacy emissions, like, we were the people that came up with the Industrial Revolution. Yes. And what was that powered by? Coal. Yes. So it's good that we're trying to do something about it now. It's something where we set up. I think our climate legislation is meant to be some of the most progressive in the world in terms of trying to bind successive governments into delivering
the long-term thing. Being a physicist is at the cornerstone of a lot of interesting things. There's hard science, but there's also the day-to-day life of people, where it's energy or even weapons.
Yeah.
And because there's a lot of fields where you're not as in touch with the environment, with the people, and you can only see just people who do the same job.
I think it depends how much you sort of specialize and what you kind of go into, because the thing that's funny about science is if you kind of go back 100 years, you could have the guy that knew this field, where he'd be like, oh, yes, I am the leading eminent expert in chemistry. Sure. And yeah, he would be the guy that knew most of it, and maybe there's like two other guys, and together they've got all of it. And over
you can find now the letters they were sending to each other.
Yeah, exactly, where they were sort of like, you know, where they were chatting it over and going, oh, hey, you know, what do you think of this relativity idea? Oh, it could be good. And so now things have like exploded. Science has exploded over the last 100 years, so that there's now so much information. Like chemistry, if you break it down into different fields, you've got like the interface between chemistry and biology, where there's like that's biochemistry. You've got all of the stuff to do with like drugs, which is related to that, but that's pharmacy and pharmacology and stuff like that. You've got like materials science, which is making is like a border, I guess, between kind of like engineering and chemistry to make new alloys and stuff. You've got just like hardcore nerd theory stuff in the middle, where people are like, but fundamentally, what is going on? I've got a friend who's been doing a PhD in what is happening here. But his thing is so specific. It's to do with like, you know, how I don't understand it. I'm not going to claim to, but it's like how quantum states flip from one to the other.
Yeah.
And he's written 80,000 words on that topic. And so it's got to the point now where science is like, you can either go deep or you can go broad, but you can't do both.
Yes.
Because it's, I mean, yeah, just so much stuff to know.
You have to create teams to do one or the other. And yeah. That's the thing. When you go deep,
yeah,
you still have to explain this to the people
to the other
around.
People who are not miles down in that
and
one
also
trench.
I mean, the for example, your friend, he's researching the quantum state of things, and yet it will impact perhaps your job in the very near future, so you have to be kind of aware of things.
Totally. Yeah, and it's something that he often complains about, is that, you know, science at its most basic, science is about asking interesting questions and trying to find out what's going on with the world. And like it's quite a deep question when you get to like, what is reality and what's actually happening? And the way that governments work is like, yeah, that's a lovely question, but I'd like you to come up with the thing that's going to replace the iPhone so that we can earn loads of money.
Yeah.
And that's a natural tension between, so, you know, a scientist might go, I've spent, you know, 30 years answering really useful questions, and a government funding grant guy might be like, yeah, but did we see anything from that? And they turn around like, yes, the advancement of human knowledge.
the even more frustrating thing, and I always complain about this, decisions that are made by our governments are never based on science, neither.
Yeah, there's a natural tension between scientists and politicians, which is that politicians like to make the world look like it's simple and that they know what's going on and they've got a plan that's going to fix things.
Yeah.
And scientists want to tell you what they know, but what they know will always have limits, will have caveats. They'll be like, given the set of conditions, I know X, Y, Z.
Yeah.
This is one of the things that's a bit of a problem with the climate change debate, is that you'll have a lot of climate scientists who go, we have 99.5% statistical confidence in this model that says that global warming is real and it's a really big problem, but which is the message, like that's the message that you need to hear. But often at the start of the climate change debate, it was phrased in scientific language, and politicians were going, well, what I'm hearing here is it's uncertain.
Yes.
And the scientific response to that is, yes, it is uncertain, but what we're uncertain about is a very small part of a very large problem.
As uncertain as the fact that you might die if you jump off the 10th floor. I mean, you might.
Yeah, exactly.
You might survive.
Statistically speaking,
yes.
There may be there's people that fall out of aeroplanes and survive.
Exactly.
It does happen because they hit the right kind of tree.
But that is something interesting, because I think even if you say there's 99% of chance that we will hit the wall, people don't want to hear that, especially politicians. So I'm thinking there's I will allow myself to be in the science, because I'm a dentist. By the way, as a dentist, sometimes I have to convince my patients of science.
Yeah.
Just for them to heal themselves.
Yeah.
But
I'm just trying to help.
Literally your health. And anyway, and
he's got an agenda. I bet it.
Yeah, exactly. He wants to sell me toothbrushes. But that's the thing. I think we have some kind of responsibility on our discourse. I mean, we have that responsibility, and let's not forget, people also have a responsibility to know what science is and what it helped them to do. I mean, you cannot say, I don't want to hear you about climate change and still use your smartphone because we use science to create that too. So,
yeah.
I mean...
yeah, I guess. Yeah, I mean, one of the things that they've done in the UK now is like research funding. One of the things that you get assessed on is how much public outreach do you do? Because we're giving you taxpayer funded money. Everyone in like what was currently in Britain called the liberal elite, the people that think Brexit is a bad idea.
Yeah.
Generally speaking, they'll be getting taxpayer money. They'll be spending it on something obscure, and it's important that exercise happens where people go, you know, the reason that we're doing this, like, so say for example, take like Joe's PhD project about quantum stuff, you might go like, yeah, this is currently, we're examining the splitting of quantum stuff on this weird molecule, and that's, so is that going to impact the everyday lives of everyone around here right now? No. But is it an interesting question? Yes. The thing that often happens is you have the interesting questions are out front, like they're on the cutting edge of science, where they're just asking what's going on here. And then behind that, you've got some slightly more applied people who are going, well, we've worked out that this, this, and this is going on. Given that, could we make something cool out of that? Maybe we could. And then from that then gets from like scientists where they kind of, like, this is where my master's was going, like, people had worked out that, oh, if we combine like bismuth, vanadium, and oxygen in these specific ways, we could make actually a fuel cell that might run like way better than our current fuel cells, and that would help us unlock hydrogen technology, and then that could help us sort out global warming. And so it's all connected, like, and you need that spike out the front of complicated questions to help inform things.
Isn't that just ignorance not to think that way? Because you say your friend is working on this, and I'm already thinking, oh yes, it might help us in chemistry, perhaps in battery cells. Is there a lack of imagination on people? Because they think it's too specific and they cannot see the big picture.
Yeah, but I think you have to have that conversation with people, because I think I'm currently reading The Kraken Wakes by John Wyndham, which is like a sci-fi in which aliens land in the sea.
Yeah.
And I haven't got to the bit where they crawled out of the sea and kill everyone, but I'm pretty sure that's coming.
Okay.
Spoiler alert. but there's an interesting line in there, which is like about, there's this scientist who is basically saying we should try and communicate with these aliens in the deep. And then like one of the journalists is chatting about him and going, oh, he's a liberal guy. And he makes the same mistake all liberal people do, which is assume people are all like them, which hit me a bit hard because I was like, yeah, I do kind of like to think that everyone has a positive view of the world, is open to discussing things and then making conclusions based on facts. And I think some of the politics, like certainly around Trump and Brexit, shows that humans don't always make decisions rationally. There's a really interesting book I read recently called The Chimp Paradox, which is by Steve Peters, who did the Olympics psychology for all of the 2012 athletes in Britain.
Yeah.
And his argument is your brain is two bits, that your brain is a human that deals with the, like, if you like, the liberal side of things, where it's like, oh yes, people are all equal, I want to have purpose and meaning in my life and good relationships with outside people. And then you have the evolutionary bit that we're sort of like dragging along,
the reptilian brain that we still have,
and that bit is very like territory, threats, self-preservation. And we have this dichotomy like stuck in all of us. And what he was saying is like, actually the chimp part is more powerful and faster than the human bit. So he was like trying to use this to train athletes by basically going, your instincts might go, I want to eat food, or I want to like go out and party with
my
friends.
That's the fight and flight thing. You have to be quick at that.
And so I think what he was sort of saying is like, your human brain like will want you to do like stick to a diet and not go out and keep training, but unless you're prepared for it, your animal instincts are always going to take over and be like, let's go to the pub, oh no, I haven't got a gold medal.
That's difficult because you have to be on the repression. We can't just shut it down, and that's the thing. We need to know as scientist to apprehend the fact that when we're talking to also someone who has this reptilian brain. So yeah. We have to be kind of cunning.
I think a lot of people's experience from science comes from school. And I think a lot of people, that wasn't a thing they found fun. Because it's inherently kind of abstract. So you're kind of like, why do I care about the disproportionation of copper, which is something we did in A-level, where we're like, you just have to know it. So I think there's the element of like people going, this is complicated and I don't feel like I get it. And I think sometimes science is taught, if it's taught to a syllabus, it's you must know the following things. Whereas that's not what science is. Science is given an uncertain set of stuff, what can you work out from it?
Yeah.
And that's much, for me, that's much, much more interesting. I don't know how many people get that.
I was literally ranting on that in my previous episode, because I episode where I just talk alone. I was thinking, you know, science is taught like religion.
Mm.
It's taught by dogmas, and sometimes you have layers of things you must know.
Yeah.
Instead of explaining how did we know that?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
What can we achieve with that knowledge to know more? We should, I think, teach that way, because every knowledge has been discovered instead of just it's written in a book.
Yeah.
So you have to believe it.
I remember when I was in school, like there's like the exams you take when you're 16, and then there's the exams you take when you're 18. And we passed the 16 exams, and for your 16 exams, atoms are a set of circles with dots and crosses on them. And then at the start of preparing for the next set of exams, they went, yeah, but what kind of world do we live in? What do you mean, what kind of world do we live in? Like, is it two-dimensional? Is everything flat? And you're like, no. Do you reckon atoms are flat? And so it's one of those things where you've been taught a convenient lie to get you to the next step. Yeah. So that you can go, you know, I said all that stuff, which you kind of got, it's close. It's not true.
Yes.
We'll go into that. And then the same thing happened again at university, where they went, hey, so you know all that stuff we taught you at A-level? Yeah, it's not real. Like that this bit about hybridization, where they just magically become the same, that's not real. Yeah. But you have to each time you have to lay down a block that will help you get to the next block, and then.
But I feel there's this comes from the laziness perhaps of teachers, you know, because
why aren't you starting with the Schrödinger equation and working from there?
No, because they're thinking, let's go tell that lie instead of just rethinking it to, because obviously you want people to have an amount of knowledge when they leave school, but what I would rather have is people who know how to acquire knowledge
Definitely.
Because a lot of people who just finished high school and went into other kind of studies, what they were taught, that's done. That's never going to change.
Mm.
You know, no, that's not how science works. We have new data and we are changing the stuff because we're understanding more.
Yeah.
And we should, I think, rethink everything to make people part of the whole thing. I'm reading a book, a science fiction novel, because we're nerds. It's called Spin. I don't remember the author, but what happens in the book is at one point in middle of the night somewhere, the stars disappear.
Uh-huh.
Turns out the Earth is surrounded by some kind of shield, and there's a fake sun, but there's no stars anymore.
Uh-huh.
And scientists, NASA, etc., want to know what's happening. But what you realize, and I think that's well written in the book, is for like 99% of the people, it doesn't change their day-to-day life, because you just, the barrier faked the sun, so it doesn't change anything.
Yeah, you have a moment where you feel kind of sad, you can't see the stars, and you get on with your life.
Exactly, we have the rent to pay, etc. But the other ones are like, no, guys, everything just disappeared. We need to look at it. And this is very interesting, because I see in that novel the real difference between people and their link to science.
Yes, And also, it's interesting, like one of the criticisms that sometimes gets thrown at climate scientists, which I find bizarre, is that they're in it for the grant funding. Like it's a corrupt inner, like they're just like their noses are in the trough and they're getting their money for funding their climate science, which I think given that that's normally said by some like billionaire who's like doing oil extraction, I'm like,
yeah.
I mean, well played trying to pin your thing on these guys.
Yeah, on those guys.
But have you ever seen a climate scientist? Like, scientists tend to be like people that like wear cardigans and drive secondhand cars.
Yeah.
They're not like
tweed jackets. And
you want to get really rich? Probably don't enter research science. Yes. I mean, it's a bit like it's slightly like stand up or like music in that there will be a few people that make it big.
Yeah.
And that's either because they're brilliant or they're lucky enough to be in the right place at the right time. And they'll be the guy that is, oh my god, rock star scientist. And they'll be able to like screw a university for a large salary. But for the vast majority of them, they're like, you know, they're middle class people bumbling along in and disappointed in the government.
Like everyone else.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Yeah, chalk it up with the rest of them.
The scientists are seen like a different cast of people. Why?
Well, I think sometimes like people do feel either they find it complicated and have no interest in it. So that's one thing. And then why do they feel like it's complicated and they don't have any interest in it? It might be because they, like I said earlier, they struggled with it in school.
Bad teachers again.
I don't know. Like, I was lucky with teachers. I had good, like, really solid set of teachers that probably got me. I was also a grade A nerd. like, I was in primary school and I read, what are you reading at the moment? The Encyclopedia.
Just such a good read.
Yeah, and the thing is that was funny is that my primary school teacher got to the point where she was I can't remember what it was. I mixed up the word, like, conifer trees with, like bell trees or something like that, and she was like, bell trees, I didn't realize that wasn't a thing. I thought you just read it in this encyclopedia. I assumed you knew what you were talking about.
She assumed you were some kind of Wikipedia.
This guy is coming out with weird facts from this book that he's reading. It was pre-Wikipedia though.
Yeah,
is it like obviously. Microsoft Encarta?
Yeah.
Did you ever have that?
Oh yeah.
Like, on the CD.
Encarta 1999, I remember.
Yes. And then you could go for like a tour of like the world's temples and like look around and be like, oh, it's...
And there was a university studio, or perhaps it was just French university. That was bump a little bit harder, you know. It was like Encarta had pictures. Yeah. Universalis was the real deal, just
the
words.
The cocaine to the marijuana of encyclopedias.
Yeah, there's also perhaps this curiosity that is innate or that can be nurtured, but it depends on what you're watching on TV, perhaps, parents.
Again, I think it's interesting we're talking about the education system, because I think this is something that... I don't think any child is born not curious about the world. Like, everyone is born going, because it's a bit of a shock. Yeah. You know, you're like, what the hell is this place? Why am I here? Who are you guys? Yeah. And so, like, I think children are naturally curious. And it depends on how you engage with them as to, like, whether or not you're... trying to let them discover stuff or whether you're being like, you have been told that you need to know that copper is blue when it's in two states, and everyone goes, yeah, well, who cares?
Yeah.
That was one of the things I found really fun with the FameLab competition, was like trying to find angles onto complicated topics. And it's one of the things that's really good with like Outrageous Acts of Science manages to sneak a lot of quite complicated science into a fun program, and that's one of the things I really do love about it, is because like there was one clip I remember where it was like internet hoaxes. So some guy had said like, oh, I'm standing with my he had a fluorescent light tube, and he was standing with it, and he went like, oh, if I point it at this star, it switches on. Then he like pointed it away and it switched off.
Yeah.
And what he had is he had like a radio frequency transmitter nearby, and that was hitting it, and he was switching it on and off when he pointed it at this thing.
Yeah.
And so it's a clever hoax, but the actual process is like, you've got radio transmitter that's sending waves, that's hitting this thing. What goes on inside that tube is actually a two-stage process where the radio waves excite one thing, that then pings off something
that's
not visible.
There's always science to be explained, even turn in the hoax.
Yeah, and then that then like then pings off something else, and that then gives you the light. And so actually you're dealing with like almost like a two or three step scientific process that if you went to any TV commissioner and said, oh, hey, we want to do a thing about like light tubes, they'd just be like, leave my office. Why are you here? Yeah, I mean, it's one of the things that's good about the show is it's there's a lot of hooks in the YouTube material because it's either like a fun personality or a big stunt or something that's genuinely just like, wow, that's weird or that's amazing. And then you can, from that, which again, it kind of comes back to what we were talking about earlier about having your emotional brain and your rational brain. Yes. It goes for the emotional brain first and goes, this is strange. Yeah. This is cool. This is wow. Oh my God. Or like, oh, this is horrible. Actually, one of the most horrible clips was this guy eating a Swedish or Norwegian thing called Zustromen.
Yeah, the fish that's horrible. Yeah, yeah.
Oh God. Oh man. And the guy was there like opening it and he almost throws up when he opens the can. And then he like picks it up and you can see he's just properly like almost retching at the thought. Then he puts it into his mouth and it's just, he can't swallow it. And it's just, it's been the most like, that one stays with me because it's properly like, oh God, that's genuinely revolting. But then from that, you can then start to go into like, oh, well, this fish got put underground and then why did it decompose? And turns out there's all these chemicals in it, two of which I think is like putrescine and cadaverine.
Okay.
They come from dead people.
Yeah.
And so that's why, why is this so disgusting? It's chemically the same thing as like trying to eat a corpse. And so, you wouldn't get to the, like, if you started off with the science, you wouldn't get people to come on the journey with you.
Yeah.
And so starting with the emotions is sometimes is a good should strategy.
Shouldn't the education system be that?
Like, I mean, I'd argue yes.
Yeah.
And I think that good teachers would know that. I think that that's definitely one of the things that I remember. We had a really good maths teacher. And he would always... He was just such an amazing personality that he would drag you into whatever he was talking about. Partly because of him and his emotional thing. Like, he would do this thing where he would be like, I he jumped onto the table in front of us. And we're all like, what the hell's going on? And he was just like, I only jump on the table if I'm going to tell you something very important.
Yes.
And we're all there like going, oh my God, what? And the thing was, after that, we all went, I was so busy looking at him being on the table, I can't remember what he actually said. And then he reiterated it to us. It was like, we do not like minus numbers in front of our X's. Now, I can't remember why exactly in terms of high school algebra that was important, but I do remember it was important. And like, it was by grabbing our attention first.
That's the thing, he used the fact that we have human brains and you have to tune your discourse to the people you're talking to.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I mean, it's funny because like the project in Somerset is such a massive project. As like, I lose track of how many people we have working on it now. I think on site we're over 3,000 people.
Okay.
And I think at peak we're going to reach 6,000 people. And there's all walks of life in that. So you have like caterers, you have guys that have worked in the construction industry since they left school. You have people like me who are science nerds. You've got finance guys. You've got project planners. You've got like your political people. Like all like it's a huge project, and it's interesting trying to communicate to different people. Like, because one of the courses I used to run as a trainer was just a one-day thing, which basically went, at the end of this isn't the formal aim, but at the end of this you should be able to survive a conversation in a pub about a nuclear reactor.
Yeah.
And that's where you're going to get to. You'll go from being like, what are we building? I don't know, and it's weird and scary, to being, we're building a thing because the old ones are switching off and it's low carbon, so that's a good thing. But safety is important because if we get this wrong, there are consequences.
Do you think there should be some kind of PR course when you start to become a scientist on specific stuff? Like, how to sell your field a little bit?
Yeah, definitely. And there are people that provide those kind of courses. And I think... it's something that, like, in the UK they have, what was it, like, there's a few different things. There's, like, Pint of Science nights where you can actually just go and have a pint with some scientists and chat about what they're doing.
That's awesome.
And then there's, like, a guy...
So you have your heralds, I guess, the messengers of your field who are going to pubs.
You have to have someone who's motivated to spend an evening chatting science in a pub, but that's not a hard sell.
Motivated by the beer, probably.
yeah. And then there's another thing called like a science show off, and there's quite a lot of science festivals as well in the UK, which I think are all, you know, that's, it's important that there's that dialogue for all the reasons we've talked about.
Yeah.
Like you it's not obvious. A lot of stuff. Like, yes, you can take it on faith that science is generally good, but one of the things that's interesting with nuclear is that, like, sometimes I get a reaction from people that goes, "Oh, yeah. Are you a bad guy?" And so, like, yeah, because, like, if you think about it, like, people don't quite know. If you say, "I'm a nuclear scientist," there's the slight thought nagging in the back of people's minds of, like, "Are you making weapons?" And the answer is no, I'm not. Don't worry about it. But there are those things where science has, you know, leapt forward. What scientists would describe as, like, "Oh, we leapt forward and we learned something." But then, like, you know, to everyone else, it'd be like this weird thing that we didn't know about caught fire and started leaking radiation across the Lake District. And so I think that, you know, you've got to have that discussion to bring people along with you, because if you don't, there's a risk that people see it like there's a risk with politics being the way it is now that you have a breakdown between of trust. That's one of the things, like, trust between people is really important, and you have to put effort into maintaining that.
If you're a politician, you might use science or nuclear plants as a scapegoat to regain trust, you know, if you lost it in any other way, like going the demagogic way.
Demagogue
way and play with the fears. People are like, "Oh, I'm like you, I don't like this," just to regain their...
It's funny because, like, one of the issues with Boris Johnson, I saw a guy doing a bit of analysis on Boris's personality, as he's now our prime minister, unfortunately. And they were saying, like, Boris Johnson's the kind of guy that looks to see where the crowd is going.
Exactly.
And then runs out in front of them and goes, "Follow me! I believed this all along." That's... I mean, I am not a fan of Theresa May, but one of the things that I will give her is she has principles and she did try to live by them. I might not have agreed with them.
Yeah.
I might have said, "I don't agree with X, Y, and Z of the things that you've done." But she does at least hold those as personal beliefs rather than just cynically being like, "What do I need to say to get elected here?"
Obviously, I'm a Democrat, but there is something interesting in the Chinese way. Because what happens is the fact that their political caste got themselves out of the electoral cycle, it means that they can think long term. What we here cannot do that much. I mean, they've started plans 10 years ago on stuff and they're still going on.
Yeah.
They've bought land in Australia for cattle and stuff like this. I mean, in France and in the UK, I assume it's the same way. A long-term thing is very hard to maintain throughout the left, the right, etc.
Definitely. I mean, interesting you talk about China. China has the biggest nuclear new build program of the world. Yeah. They've got, I lose track, I think it's 18 reactors under construction in China, which is why I sometimes...
Oh, under construction,
They're building them. And this is one of the things which I often find funny when people go like, "But what, we can't give China nuclear technology." It's like, China's already got nuclear technology. They've had it for ages. It's like, if you want to go back, I don't know, go back to the 70s and maybe, like, lobby people then.
You're a little bit too late.
That boat has sailed, my friend.
India and Pakistan have it, so China definitely has it.
Exactly. But yeah, that, like, long-term planning is a real... it's a real challenge because it kind of comes up against this idea of, like, you know, free market economics. And for me, it's like trying to put... It's interesting because it's like we were saying earlier about, like, maps of, like, what's going on in your head and you're like your way of viewing the world. It's painful redrawing your view of the world. And often you have, like, I think at the moment, a lot of people are applying what Margaret Thatcher had in her head, being like, we'll deregulate, we'll just, like, you know, cut taxes and that'll sort everything out. And that's not what people are that's not what people want. People aren't saying, "God, I feel like the government's intervening far too much in my life." They're currently going, like, "I don't have stable employment. I'd quite like there not to be this, like, massive inequality building up in the country." And so it's funny with Brexit. People are I think the Brexit referendum was sort of interpreted as a question of, "Are you happy?" And the answer was no.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm not happy.
It was too broad of a question, and it crystallized.
The thing that's really funny about, like, the Brexit, I know arguments in terms of Brexit that are based on the idea of we need to leave Europe because Europe is too free market. And we want to install a more left-wing style of thing, which is like some people with like Labour left-wing views have been like, we need to leave. I fundamentally disagree with them because I think the idea that Britain goes more to the left by leaving Europe is insane.
But usually the extremes kind of join each other in their decisions.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And then you've got people on the right who are going, oh, Europe's doing all this regulation and stuff. And the thing that I find, because again, this is a dull thing that I have done in my career, I have updated a document based on EU legislation.
Okay.
The fun detail, there's a thing called the Seveso Directive, which is about how you label how you store dangerous chemicals on sites to avoid those sites exploding,
yes.
Which is obviously a good idea.
Yes.
But the interesting thing about seeing it on an international project is the way it's implemented in France and the way it's implemented in the UK is totally different.
Oh, really?
And it's entirely like, yeah, so like...
It's based on the same text.
Yeah, so they'll say you need to minimize risk on your site. And then people go, what does that risk, what does that mean? Mm. So for the UK, we'd go... Like France's approach was, we have these dangerous chemicals, we want the smallest possible quantities of them on our site, so that what we'll do is we'll have concentrated but small tanks in contained areas. And then the British approach will be, well, actually, I don't want concentrated chemicals.
I want to spread
I want a dilute chemical, because a dilute chemical is not as chemically powerful as a concentrated chemical, which means I'll have massive tanks, they'll be huge, but they won't contain something that's as nasty. And so you can see how two countries have taken completely different things. But also, this is one of the things where I kick back on the idea that EU is stifling people from implementing solutions that fit their contexts. Because for me, that's a perfect example of, like, France has a way of operating that's worked for it. It knows how it works. It's not implementing some big change. Mm. Like, as I guarantee you, if they say, if the EU said France has to do what the UK is doing, there'd be a huge fuss. Because people would go, these buildings aren't big enough, they're small tanks, we've got all this fire protection kit, why are you kicking off this way? If you did the same thing with Britain, if you told Britain you have to implement it the French way, Britain would kick off. And so what it's driving is, are you getting control of your industrial sites and are you stopping them exploding?
Yeah.
And the answer is, yeah, people have taken actions to do that. Those actions are different based on their contexts. And I think that's one of the things that really does get lost in the debate about Europe, is that actually there's quite a lot of flexibility about how you implement these regulations. And I think people in the UK would probably point to regulations around fishing and things like that as things that annoyed them. But I think a large amount of regulations are just kind of common sense.
Yeah, there's a leeway in like, some stuff, but that's also good because that's actually an experiment, because you can see the two way, and then in 15 years, you have more dead people on that side. I want to believe that there will be a point where the masses will be enlightened enough. Mm-hmm. To just agree with a long-term thing for once. You know what I'm saying? It's like, if you can just leave your emotional part just long enough to say, okay, that seems right, even though we're just going to vote for this party for the next 5 years, we are still going to be okay with that plan, with that long plan.
Yeah.
And I don't know how we can reach that level of, you know, understanding of the complexities of science and politics, but...
It's an age-old question, I guess.
Perhaps thanks to aliens, we...
aliens will turn up, and then based on that, we'll all go, right, well, we'll kill them first and work out what we're doing with the trains later, and everyone's unified around a specific project.
Yeah, exactly. But that's fun that in the UK you have a more and more science show. I think there it's kind of starting now. I know I left Toulouse just when there was a science comedy show, so I lost that. But I mean, I have bits on anti-vaxxers, I have bits on the flat earthers, so I like those conspiracy theories. I like to make fun of those people.
Yeah.
And actually just putting real science in it. Perhaps Tony Stark, you know, going back the other way to glorify a little bit the scientists instead of thinking of nerds all the time.
Yes, yeah, but it depends which ones you send out to do the gigs.
That will be our job then. Do you have anything to add? Do you want to say something about like what you liked here in France for your short? Wait, you've been here for how many?
2 years.
2 years. Sorry, 2 years. 2 years. You've seen how French people work. How they take vacations.
Yes. I mean, the vacations are great.
Yeah.
That is something we should replicate.
What will you miss? Because now you're going to Bristol this week. So
next week.
Next
week. Next week on Friday. I am going, it's obvious, but like the bread, the wine, the patisserie, you guys got that nailed.
How will you manage in Bristol?
Yeah, I'm going to be such a snob. And the truth is, with the wine, you keep all the good wine for yourselves.
You really do. We don't export the good wine,
so
you think?
It's interesting. Like, I went to the Salon du Vin, the wine exhibit in Paris, the annual thing. And I had a chat with a guy there, and he was like, oh, yeah, I think my wine would sell quite well in the UK, but I don't really know how to do it. And whenever I talk to a distributor, all they want to do is take the cheapest possible wine and then double the price and sell it in the UK. Because the simple fact is, we're not as cultured and discerning in the UK. Like,
and obviously you will never be if we send the cheapest wine every time.
It's like, before I came to France, I never understood why French people who'd come to the UK were unhappy with the wine selection. And now I'm like, I can get that. It's really good.
So the food mainly, the gastronomy.
The food and the gastronomy is brilliant. What else? Paris is just it's a very pretty city, and there's a lot of cool museums and exhibits and things like that. I guess my personal favorite is the Orangery. The Orangery with Monet's water lilies is a painting I could quite happily sit in front of for, I don't know, an hour or so, because it just feels like sitting next to a nice, calm pond.
Yeah.
And you don't get that feeling in Paris very often.
That's true. So sometimes we can forget it, that Paris is quite beautiful. And
definitely.
I went to Tel Aviv a few years ago, and that's when it hit me that Paris was beautiful.
Yeah.
Because not to spit on Tel Aviv, but it's like concrete, not that many historical things. Mm. And then you come back here, and there's an intersection, and there's like 12 statues of great things and gold on it. And you're like, oh yeah, that's
not
something.
Normal.
Yeah, that's not, not they don't have that everywhere.
Yeah.
But I guess you get used to it. Yeah.
It's funny, like London is much more chaotic, because it got bombed. There's old bits that survived and then new bits, and I think that because Paris had that reset point. I can't remember what it was. There was a point where they like leveled all the old buildings, and a town planner came in. Was it Haussmann?
I'm
just going to organize this place.
Yes,
there'll be long boulevards. They will go from here to here. There will be sight lines. This is how it's all going to work. But it basically meant that you had to like level all the old buildings and throw out the new stuff.
But yet it's already kind of old.
It's been around a while now, I guess. And also the open mic comedy scene, because like it's a frustration of mine that I only found this towards the end of I had to make a decision about whether or not I was staying in Paris or not start of the year. And I was like, right, I think I'm going to go back to the UK. And then after that decision got made, suddenly found the open mic circuit in English, and it's just been such good fun. And I'm now being like, if I knew this earlier, maybe I'd have stayed.
That would have weighed in your decision, you think?
I think so. I think because it's been a really good play, really good way to meet people. I just have a good time. Like, it's just been really good. Yeah, wait for me to get my comedy fix.
How is life as an expat in Paris? I guess your first circle would be your coworkers, perhaps.
I think it's been one of the things that we found tricky was finding that first circle. So you'd have coworkers who are British expats.
Yes.
So you'd have the like we're lost in this city together.
Yes.
Vibe. But then like branching out from that, it's something that I'll be honest with, I've struggled with to like.
Did you use like some kind of apps or other intonations or some websites to do stuff?
Like I think we did, like did a few meetups and things like that. But yeah, just like trying to branch out. And then basically the best thing that happened to me was the Facebook ad for Krishna's comedy time at the Bootleg Bar. And I just went like. And it was literally about, I don't know, it must have been about 50 minutes before the show was about to start, and I was still in work at the time. And I looked at it and went, it's 45 minutes on the metro, it's 50 minutes till the show.
I can make it.
I can make that, yeah.
To soothe you, I would say that even for me, my whole life was in Toulouse, and coming to the big city and with my girlfriend, and I mean, as a couple, it's kind of difficult to regain the whole social life and finding the good people. And also, you don't have the excuse when you're French. It's like, how come you don't have friends? But you know, when you're 30, you can start to become picky for your friends.
Yes, I can choose who I hang out with now. Not like university, where like, you're all co-located, you will be friends.
We're in the same building. Great.
No, it's funny. I think I have a very different view of France. When I first came out, I was like, all the French, like, you know, can be quite abrupt. Sometimes can be quite rude. There's a lot of people that like to shout at each other in the street. And then I went outside Paris. And I realized it's Paris. Like that is a Paris thing. And so like the trips that I've had out to the other parts of France have been like a Disney film where you know that you sort of you leave the dark forests of Paris and you suddenly get out and these little birds start appearing and these like cheerful locals come up and go, "Oh, you're you know what? Your French is actually very good." And like no one says this to me in Paris.
You started with the level 10 hardcore level with Paris.
Yeah,
and then after this, it's,
I should have gone and lived in the countryside and then moved in after a year once I knew how to speak French.
Are Parisian that annoying when you try to speak French?
So that's something that was really difficult because obviously the only way you learn a language is by speaking a language. Yes. And Paris is a city, in fairness to the waiting staff of this city, with a lot of tourists.
Yeah.
So they have great English. I get that their lives will be easier if they don't have to put up with me struggling through a menu in French. But it was one of those things that was like, I got to the point where I was like, no, I know how to order in French. Yeah. I actually have all the vocabulary down. I know what the questions are. I know how to deal with this interaction. I know my accent is British.
Yes.
But you'd have to like basically get through a conversation where you'd be speaking to them in French, they'd be speaking to you in English, and you'd have to not let your English brain take over.
Yeah.
You just have to like grind your way through.
That's difficult when, in the service industry, they want to accommodate you, but if you want to learn, then it's all fucked up. Yeah. Please talk to me in French. I want to improve my French. That's good.
But like, I mean, I learned a lot from work where I just got immersed in it.
Yes.
And basically spent the first 4 months of being here utterly exhausted.
Yeah.
And then came back after Christmas and was like, oh, actually, no, I have made some progress. I did.
Yeah, it demands a focus. That's, that's kind of training.
And I think it's one of the things that we as Brits are famously bad at is having... Yeah, because it's amazing chatting to people in Paris where you go like, oh, yeah, I speak English, I speak French, I speak Spanish, I speak Farsi or you know whatever it is. And people come along with, they're like, yeah, I speak multiple languages. It's normal because they've grown up in a country that's not the US, Canada or the UK. And so they've had to. And something we should be better at.
I always want to show off a little bit. I perform in French and in English, and there's some guy, I perform in French and English, Spanish, Arabic, and I'm like, okay, you win.
Yeah.
And it is funnier. Okay.
Yeah. Oh, and you got more laughs. Yeah. Brilliant.
Fun. So what's next? The improv again? Some stand up perhaps? Now that you have a great level in stand up, thanks to Paris,
a world beating level at stand up. Which So I think objectives for Bristol. I would like to keep up the stand up. I've got a long time comedy collaborator who lives in Bristol. That's great. And he does a lot of improv, but we've done sketches and scripted stuff together. So we're going to have a pint in September, and we're going to work out some plans.
Yes.
One of the things I'd like to do is, like, some guys I know through the improv scene in London have recently released a short film and miniseries called Spock.
Yeah.
S-P-O-K-K-E.
Okay.
And it's a... Have you ever watched the Scandi noir crime dramas? They were really big in the UK. So it's like Scandinavian crime thrillers.
Yes.
So like The Bridge, like where person gets murdered in the middle of the bridge, and they're like, it's basically it's a parody of that.
Oh,
but instead
that can be funny because I like those Scandinavian
noir. Yeah. So they have, it's a really good little short. It's been nominated and won for a lot of awards, and it's basically someone has abandoned a bike on a bridge in between Gloucestershire and Somerset. And it's inch perfect. And from there, they have to go off and investigate. Plugging their thing. It's available on this website called Punkanary. Like punk anary. It's kind of like a portmanteau between canary and punk. But it's like something like £12 for the year. And it's got lots of experimental comedy on there. So, like, people...
If you have a link, I can put in the description of the episode.
And Sean and Tim, you can pay me later.
That's cool. You have to plug, friends, friends shows.
Yeah, so it's been really cool seeing their film do so well. And it's something where I kind of go, I'd like to have a go at that.
Yeah.
I'd like to have a go at that.
Yeah.
Should write something. I don't know. Stand up, write stuff. Try and push some more science presenting and
changing the world.
Change the world. That make it sound so easy.
Is that a need that you have to write stuff?
I have a need to be involved in comedy.
Yeah.
It's one of the things that I've learned about myself is that it doesn't necessarily need to be like my sole source of support, but if I'm not doing it, I'm miserable.
Okay.
And it's got to the point where not only do I know this, but my wife knows this as well. So to a point where she's like, just go and do an open mic night.
Yeah.
Just go do something. So she has to support this. Do something so that you become a bit more cheerful.
Does she put up a fake stage sometime? If you don't have an open mic, please just take this. Do your jokes.
That'll be the point where I've gone fully insane. Performing to myself in my living room. Oh, hey guys, is everyone having a good time?
Yes.
That feels like, I don't know, the end of some kind of thriller film about, like, psychological thriller about this comedian.
It was him the whole time.
It's like A Beautiful Mind, but with comedy.
This should be a parody, by the way. We'll miss you here in Paris.
I will be honest, I will try and arrange any meetings I have in Paris around when there's comedy nights on and do my level best to get back for them.
Well, thank you very much, Alistair.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Well, that's fun. And, I wish you a good moving. Good
thanks.
Installation? How do we
say it? Move, I guess.
Move. Yeah, good move in Bristol.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's the best way of saying that. Hey, thank you.
In a white room with black curtains near the station. Black roof country, no gold pavement, tired starling. Dark eye, dawn light smile on you leaving my contentment. I'll wait in this place where the sun never shines. Wait in this place where the station. That one ticket, restless.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.